Have a seat if you would this morning. And in just a little bit, we have a couple of baptisms, which will be really cool and fun. And on our way there, I want to introduce a question that will get you thinking about my sermon topic this morning. We're kind of second week early into a series on Elisha, the follow-up prophet to Elijah. He, of course, as you recall last week, was the one that said, "I'll be second." And so my sermon last week, "I am second." And it raises the question, how willing are we to be second? How willing are we to say, "God, you take the lead and I'll follow"? And that's a difficult prospect. It's something that's required of a follower of Jesus all the time. It's not part-time, it's not occasional, it's not at the beginning and then you're on your own. It's constant, and it's a daily thing. But let me get to my question. How do you define, what does it mean to be a minister? It's a question we could spend a lot of time. It would be fun to have a conversation about it. Say, what do you say when it comes to being a minister? Now, most people I have observed over the years are off, and some are way off when it comes to their understanding of being a minister. And first off, most people think it has to do with the man in the pulpit or the clergy, the people that we call pastors or leaders in the church. And the Bible emphatically says, no, if you belong to Jesus, you are a minister. Every member of the body of Christ is a minister. So we're already off. But one of my favorite, and it's used by my neighbors still, we've been on the same street for a long time. Hey, here comes the man of the cloth. I'm not sure what's meant by the man of the cloth. I know I don't carry a handkerchief, so it couldn't apply to me. I do not have a cloth with me. But I know that I've been referred to that, still am, by some people, and I did some searching, and I found that actually there's a history behind that. Man of the cloth, it turns out it's an expression used to originally in a common kind of generic way of articles of clothing worn at work. So if you think of it that way, it's clothes of a calling. And it, originally it was, let's think of a baker for a minute, okay? So you heard an announcement about earlier about a cooking thing we're doing, right? Rice and lice, or what is it? Dice and lice or something. I forget lice, but anyway, you get the idea. So here's the deal. What's a chef wear?
Apron.
Apron, that's a good start. And what color is it usually?
White,
at least when he shows up, and then, okay. And then what else? White pants, right? White shirt, what else?
White hat.
White hat, okay. He is wearing the garb of his work, or those are the clothes of a baker's calling. A cop wears a uniform, okay? That is, in fact, his cloth in his work. But over time, it became known as a description only of a more narrow view or narrow group of people, the clergy. And it had to do with in our work, in the work of pastors, in some traditions, there's some heavy garments that are worn. Have you know? I mean, like the priest work in some settings, or there's vestments, what they're called, okay? And these heavy garments are sort of have become known as the cloth. I've done weddings at lots of different churches that are different than our tradition. Presbyterian, I've done weddings in Lutheran churches, weddings in Catholic churches, and frequently I'm offered a robe to wear. And I don't know if you've ever gone up close to a pastor or somebody, a priest in one of those traditions, but get up close and you'll notice it's heavy. It's a big, it's bigger than one of those fancy robes you get in a high-end hotel to wear, you know, a bathrobe. And one time I did a wedding in Washington, D.C. at Fourth Press, and the pastor, we kind of tag-teamed it, And he when I walked into his office, he had his vestment on, and he offered me a robe. And I thought, well, okay, I'll put it on. You know, that's what you do here. So I put this thing on, and we rolled into it. Almost immediately, I felt my temperature go up. I mean, like, and this thing's full-on wool, okay? Rag wool, I think. But, and it wasn't 20 minutes into this thing that I am, I looked like my lab looking for a bowl of water. I mean, I was dying. And at the end of the service, I mean, I'm 32 pounds lighter from all the sweat I poured during this brief ceremony. And this pastor says to me, man, you look like you were like overheated. And I said, you think? You know? And then he goes, you know, actually, when we wear these, I only have a t-shirt and shorts on underneath. I go, hey, how about that? That would be a good thing to say to a guest, all right? So that's the cloth thing, right? Man of the cloth. What is a minister? Oh, one of my favorite told to me by a friend, you know what a minister, I'll tell you what a minister is. Ministers get paid to be good. The rest of us are good for nothing. So here's the deal. In actual fact, the term minister comes from the same word in Latin for servants. All right? And if you trace that word further back, you find that it comes out to a root word, minus, which means less. Now, I've just given you something to take away this morning already. The truth is, we live in a world that says, are you kidding me? Less? No. Best? First? Number one? All about me? I call the shots. But a calling to be a minister, which doesn't belong, by the way, to clergy, it belongs to all people who belong to Jesus, is a calling to be less. It's a calling to be, as we learned last week, second. Not just a band that's easy to wear, but a description of identity. So, this morning, for a little time, I want us to take a look back into 1 Kings, and I'd like you to locate page 247. If you didn't bring a Bible, just reach for one in a chair near you, and it's keyed right to 1 Kings chapter 19. New on the scene and needing clarity is Elisha, the follow-up, the second to Elijah, the great prophet of Israel, during some very difficult days, the days of Ahab. Page 247, 1 Kings 19. And if you're taking notes this morning, may I give you a principle that you'll quickly identify with in Elisha's life, and probably, if you haven't already, in your own life. Elisha's call was costly. To be a minister will cost you. To do what God has called you to be and do will cost you. Jesus said it best. If anyone wants to come after me, let him, Luke 9:23, deny himself. That is not easy to do today or any day. Deny yourself. Take up your cross. How often? Yeah, not weekly, monthly, occasionally at conferences or Christmas and Easter. Take up your cross daily and do what is counterintuitive and completely unnatural. Become a follower of me. It won't come easy. Dietrich Bonhoeffer came along back in yesteryear, and he said, when God calls a man or a woman, he bids them come and die. Now, die some ugly, grotesque death? No, just die to self, the hardest death of all. All right? So, Elisha, like you and me today, his call, God's call on his life was costly. You remember lots of details to this. Go on the website and look up past sermons in this recent series we finished, Elijah's Survivor Man. And you remember he hit the wall, lonely, wanted to die, defeated, And God does a number of things to restore his ailing prophet, his struggling servant. And one of the things he does, he says to him, I've got somebody I want you to go and anoint and bring him close to you and let him shadow you. We learned last week that happened, and it lasted about a 10-year stretch of time. But it all comes to verse 16, where God says, I want you to go, and I want you to anoint, notice these words, Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Meholah, to succeed you as a prophet. Now drop down, and this is how it happened. So Elijah went from there, verse 19, and found Elisha, son of Shaphat. He was plowing. Make note of what he was doing. Plowing with 12 yoke of oxen, and he himself was driving the 12th pair. Elijah went up to him, threw his cloak of anointing around him. And Elisha then left his ox and ran after Elijah. Let me kiss my father and mother goodbye, he said, and then I will come with you. Go back, Elijah replied. That's fine with me. Go back and remember what I've done to you. It's asked in a question in New International. It's more of a statement. Go back. Remember. Don't forget what I've done. So Elisha left him, went back home to his mom and dad, and he took his yoke of oxen, slaughtered them. He burned them, burned the plowing equipment to cook the meat and gave it to the people, and they ate. And then he set out to follow Elijah and became his second, his servant. Elisha is now anointed to follow as the successor of Elijah. Now, we noted last week that his call on Elisha was while he was working. Okay? There's more to notice about Elisha's station in life, so I want you to just kind of pause a second more. Let me draw attention to a few of these details. These are true facts of his situation when God called him. Notice, first of all, he wasn't one who couldn't cut it in some other work of life and thought, well, might as well try ministry. Okay? That would be an incorrect understanding of Elisha. It's also an incorrect understanding today. Somebody that somehow can't seem to get traction in life says, you know what? I'll go and become a clergy. I'll go and become a minister. No, that's not the way to do it. By the way, it is done that way, and you look at their lives years later and you wonder, how did you get here? What's the deal? Because here's the fact, and we know this true, is in the church, in ministry, we're gracious. We embrace people, so come as you are. And Elijah is someone who's got a life, got a job, is doing his best. He's involved, and in the midst of that, God comes to him and says, I got bigger fish to fry. I got bigger plans on your life. Notice next, he was the son of well-to-do a family. He comes from Shaphat. We don't know anything about him except what's furnished in verse 19. He evidently, we're not told the size of the field, but he's plowing with 12 yoke of oxen. That's a big plow. That's a lot. There's presumably plenty of land there. And he's plowing this land. And he's closely connected to his parents. Don't overlook the fact that he's quite intent on saying, listen, I want to follow you, Elijah. Great privilege. But I want to make sure and say goodbye to my parents. Trust me on this. You could look further in Kings and over in Chronicles, the only two places we have information about this period of time, and there's not a single reference to the thought that Elisha later in his life came back home. No wonder he wanted to say goodbye. It's important to me to say goodbye to my family. It's important that I properly honor my parents as I venture forth into something that there's no looking back from. He did that, and he never returned from that. he was saying, and we might use these words today, Lord, I'm all in for you. I want to be completely in, not partially in. I want to show you something real quick, and I'll have you turn, hold your place here. I'll have you turn over in the New Testament. There's four Gospels that tell us all we need to know about Jesus: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Go to the third Gospel, the Gospel of Luke. Would you turn to page 729 for a moment? Because this comes straight from Jesus. When he was talking to people, there was a crowd gathered, a lot of tire kickers. A lot of people going, I like this. Luke chapter 14, okay? Luke 14. He said something similar when many people by now are gathered around him going, I want a piece of this action. This is good. He's a head turner. He's a guy I want to be around. Jesus, knowing that this kind of crowd had gathered, we're told in verse 25 of Luke 14, a large crowd, Jesus turns to them and says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brother and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciples. Are you kidding me? Did I get that right? Read on. Whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down, estimate the cost, see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and aren't able to finish, everyone's going to see it and ridicule you for it. And they're going to say, you know, this person didn't have their act together. They couldn't finish. They started, but then they stuttered and failed. Or suppose a king, he switches metaphors now, suppose a king's about to go to war against another king. Won't he first sit down, calculate the cost, consider what he's able to do with 10,000 against an opponent of 20,000? If he's not able, he'll send a delegation offering terms of peace. In the same way, those of you who do not give up everything you have cannot be my disciples. Now, I don't know who you are, but you can't read that indifferently. You can't. You can stumble over it, and many did and do. But you would be making a bad choice to say, you know what, I'm going to tear that puppy out of there. Because that's a little over the line. Jesus, you're a little over the top. You're asking for lots from my life. And Jesus would look at you in compassion and say, you got it. But not quite. I'm asking for all of your life. Not a lot. All. He would say, either I am Lord of all of you, or I'm not Lord at all of you. Jesus wasn't saying, hey, listen, okay, here's your checklist to see if you're ready. Do you hate your mom and dad? Why would he contradict what he's taught elsewhere? Properly honor them. What we saw in Elisha already. That doesn't make any sense at all. It's inconsistent. But he is saying, if your motive in following me is a career move, if your motive in following me is easy street or short hours or something like that, dumb approach, you will run out of reasons. And frankly, your tank will run dry real quick, real quick. I want you to love your family. Just make sure you love me more. Now, back in 2 Kings or 1 Kings, and flip a couple of pages to where we'll spend the balance of a few moments together. 2 Kings chapter 2. It really kind of takes on a speed now. We write this principle down. Elijah's commitment is tested. Okay. His commitment is costly. The commitment that he's called to make, the call of God on all of our lives, costly. In Elisha's case, his commitment is going to be tested. You'll see that in these first six verses. We only have time to kind of briefly brush into this. Hopefully you'll go deeper, and we're going to do so in the coming weeks. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind. Now this is 10 years later. from what we just read in 1 Kings 19. Okay, so 2 Kings 2, verse 1. Elisha and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Please circle four locations that we're going to bump into real quick here, just one after the other. Elijah and Elisha walking together on their way from at Gilgal. Elijah says to Elisha, stay here. The Lord has sent me on to second location, Bethel. We'll come, these all have significance. But Elisha said, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So they went on to Bethel. The company of the prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, do you know the Lord is going to take your master from you today? Yes, I know, Elisha replied, so be quiet. It was bother to hear that. It's like, hey, do you know your best friend's going away today? Just thought I'd point that out. Bearer of good news. Please be quiet. Then Elisha says to him, stay here, Elisha. Elijah says to Elisha, stay here. The Lord has sent me on to a third city, Jericho. And he replied, as surely, repeats himself, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So they went on to Jericho. The company of the prophets at Jericho, so we're reading about two different schools of prophets, went up to Elisha and asked him, do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today? I observe here also, they're doing all of this in a day. Did you notice that? There's a ton of movement. They're on the go. He says, yes, repeats himself. I know that, so be quiet. Then Elijah said to him, stay here. The Lord has sent me on one last location, Jordan. It's the river Jordan. And he replied, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So the two of them walked on. Elijah's commitment is being tested. He came after having Elijah's cloak placed on him, saying goodbye to his family, and he clings to Elijah to learn at his feet, to listen to his teaching, to absorb all he can. And here we are 10 years later. They haven't yet parted ways, and his commitment to Elijah is being tested. In all those locations I've just mentioned, Gilgal, Bethel, Jericho, and the Jordan River, if you were to take time on a map in the back of your Bible, you would notice that all of them combined is about a 20-mile radius. It's not distance. But 20 miles in a day is how they're traveling. We could speculate, how did it happen like a Star Trek episode, and they, you know, I don't even know the word, where they, you know.
Transported.
Is that it? Transported? Yeah. Did it? I doubt it. But maybe. Or they traveled 20 miles. And you can do that. They're moving just short of a marathon. They're on the go. So they come to Gilgal. Let's just touch on a couple of observations of each of these locations. Gilgal was the first place Elijah says to Elisha, stay here. Now, Gilgal is a location where Israelites under Joshua, back in Joshua chapter 4, which if you're counting years, is 400 years before this time. It's the first city after they cross the Jordan River. The river parts and they move into the promised land. And God said on their way through the river, pick up stones and make a monument. And he even told them why. He says, so that in future generations, people are going to look at this pile of rocks and say, hey, what's this all about? What's the deal? And you're able to go back and say, well, they actually, you know where those rocks are from? The river. What, did you dive in and get them? No, the river's parted, and you tell the story of God's promised deliverance and the final arrival in the land God promised them. So Gilgal is like, pick your favorite place. It's like way up next to it. Wow. This would be a great place to stay and live. Right here in this wonderful beginning to the promised land. Very tempting for him to stay. This would have had major spiritual appeal to Elisha. You could stay here. Holy, desirable, attractive. But his plans instead said, no, I'm going to stay with you, Elijah. You're not gone, and I'm not going anywhere. Next stop, Bethel. They continue on. Remember why Bethel stands out? You probably remember reading this name in the Bible, because it really came into significance back in the days where Canaanites, it was a Canaanite city, clear back in Genesis chapter 28. There's this great godly man named Jacob. And he goes to this Canaanite city known as Luz, L-U-Z. And while he's there, he's tired from a long journey. He finds a rock, and he uses it as a pillow and decides to go to sleep. Falls into a deep sleep. And you remember what happened in his dream? He saw something of a staircase or a ladder that descended or connected earth to heaven. Somehow in this deep dream, he sees people on this ladder, and looking closely, he sees that they're angels. And they're going up to heaven and down back to earth and up again and back down. And as he's watching this, taking it all in, he hears as he wakes up from that dream and just like pinch me moment. He hears this from God. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. All people on earth will be blessed through you. I am with you and will watch over you, and I will fulfill everything that I am promising you. That's all out of Genesis 28. So when they come to Bethel, it's a big deal. By the way, it was renamed from Luz to Bethel, which means house of God. It's a glorious place to be. Bethel was the place where the Ark of the Covenant stayed temporarily during the days of the judges, which our Bible tells about by that name, the book of Judges. It's a very significant place, and I called your attention to it earlier, but twice we're told, and once in Bethel, once down in Jericho, of these companies of the prophets. These are schools. We would maybe use the word seminaries today, of prophets that go there to learn the calling of a prophet, the work of ministry, we might say today. And part of that was always associated with an Elijah-Elisha relationship. So that is, you go there, you learn a lot, but you're also attached to a senior prophet. And somebody there is working with you, mentoring you in the ways of being a prophet. So once again, Elijah offers to Elisha that he stay in this really wonderful place, and he says, nothing doing. So the next stop from there is, of course, Jericho. And most of us start to go, I know Jericho. By the way, it was an immediate U-turn from Bethel, the furthest west they went. They do a U-turn and head east 12 miles, and they arrive at Jericho. And, of course, what was Jericho's significance? The walls, right? The walls of Jericho. The people have come into the land, and at Gilgal, they are told God's plan, once you've healed from circumcision, is we're going to take on Jericho. That's the first city that's going to fall, and God announces how he's going to do that. And he tells that you're to circle the city, Joshua, who was the leader. You're to take the priests and the Israeli army, and you're to circle the city once a day for 7 days. On the seventh day, circle it seven times. And an extraordinary miracle transpired in front of them. They were part of something that no human could claim credit for. You ever been in a moment like that? I mean, there's nothing like it. It's like, how did this happen? It came from a church that exploded in size from 700 to 10,000 people, and no one had a good answer, and that was wonderful. No one could point to another human and say, well, that's the reason. They tried to. Well, you got Swindoll here. Next question. Well, no. He was the first to say, are you kidding me? I'm just a guy. God was able to pull off something so extraordinary at a Jericho. Not a single sword was drawn. Not one arrow was flung. It was all God. I want to leave you with one thought on this. When Jericho fell, if you were there, it would do some serious damage in your life. in a good sense. You'd never be the same. I know my human nature. I'd want to say, okay, God, next city we take, let's do it the same way. That was really cool. It was really cool. How many more Jericho stories are there in the Bible? Anybody? Two, three, four? Go Ducks. No, zero. Zero. Why would God do it like that? Because almost immediately humans begin to kind of trust in the method. Instead of say, God, you did this. You did this. And when he did it, he said this. I want to read this to you. Joshua chapter 6 records these words. They're so easily overlooked. You got to get to Joshua 6, the end of the chapter. If I ever turn to the right page and go, okay. At this time, Joshua pronounces this solemn oath, cursed before the Lord is anyone who undertakes to rebuild this city, Jericho. In other words, when it went down, God wanted it to stay down. At the cost, listen to this carefully because it'll make sense in a moment. At the cost of his firstborn son, he will lay its foundations. At the cost of his youngest son, he will set up its gates. Done. Everybody went, I don't want a thing to do with Jericho. And then 550 years later, guess what? Somebody came up with the bright idea of rebuilding Jericho. You're close enough. So would you back up about four pages to 1 Kings chapter 16? We didn't even slow down to consider this when we were studying Elijah, the last series on Survivor Man. But I want to call your attention to the last verse, verse 34. 1 Kings 34, remember, Ahab's the evil king, he's in charge, and he sends somebody, you probably blew right by his name in the Bible. Hiel is his name. Look at verse 34. In Ahab's time, Hiel of Bethel did what? Rebuilt. Where? Jericho. Hold on, didn't God say don't do that? 550 years ago? Yeah, but that was back then. I'm sure God's gotten over his bad attitude toward Jericho by now. Right? Hiel laid its foundations, what's it say next? At the cost of his firstborn son, Abiram. Easy to read that sentence. The devastating death of his firstborn son, his oldest. He's not done. And he finished the job, set up its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Segub. Another easy sentence to read. His baby died. In accordance with the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua, son of Nun. People, I take time to call your attention to that for this reason. When God says he's going to do something, he does it. This is in the Bible to remind us that we can absolutely count on God and his word. We can count when God says, I will be with you no matter what. It means exactly that. It means when God promises to provide for you, he will provide for you. It means that when God says, I'm coming back someday for my people and I will judge the evil people in the world who've refused to repent and acknowledge my son Jesus, he will do that. If you're here today and you're weary about something in your life, can your faith find new strength in knowing that God 550 years later kept his promise. He still does. And let me say something quickly about the size of challenges. Maybe your problems are Jericho in size. Big walls, thick walls. Your relationship is an impenetrable mess. It cannot be improved. You've tried everything. You've given up once and then given up again. You're still in it, but man, you're weary. Your job situation is not improving. You're still unemployed. You feel kind of that creeping dignity loss. You don't want it. You want a job. That's a wall. How's that wall going to come down? People, God took down the walls of Jericho, and he still takes down walls. And you know what? He doesn't do it through human ingenuity. I could go on the rest of the afternoon and tell you, my Seahawk fans wouldn't appreciate me, so I won't do that. But I could tell you all kinds of overwhelming things, prospects in my life, in my family. But I trust a God that says, you know what, those walls are no big deal. And by the way, stand by and watch me do it. Really, I'll do it. Let me just leave you with a last thought this morning. There's so much more, but I want to leave this. Please understand something here. We've listed some great places. We haven't even gotten to the Jordan. Are you kidding me? What a cool place. By the way, the Jordan River, when it parted ways, it was symbolic. It was a river. It's where Israel crossed from the wilderness wanderings for four decades into the land God promised them. There's no place in this list of cool places tempting to stay that trumped Jordan River. 900 years later, guess what happened in that same location? Jesus Christ was baptized, came out of the water and saw the Holy Spirit descending like a dove, we're told, and heard the voice of his Father. And from that moment on, Jesus set his sights for Jerusalem to do what he came to do, to give his life. It's the place of no turning back. The Jordan has always represented that. Elijah would soon leave, and a chariot of fire would take him up to heaven, and there's no coming back, no turning back. It's where Elisha started his ministry. There's no return. So have you come to the Jordan, I guess, is my question today. That I'm not going to look back place in life. You met Jesus, have you? Been forgiven of the sins that kept you out of a relationship with him? Because that's the only way you're going to find your purpose. The only way. Fourth century church father, he was known as. He's a great leader. St. Augustine made a great statement. He said, by the way, he loved God. He loved God. A long time ago, he said, our hearts, you have made us, O God, to know you. You have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. I don't know if you found rest yet. I do know this. If you're looking for it in other places, you'll still be sleepy. You won't be restful. You'll stay restless. I'd like you to bow your heads with me this morning. God, thank you that you're good for truths that we read about that are centuries ago and yet have great relevance to where we live today. God, I'm tempted sometimes in my own life to go back to, sometimes I call them the glory days, those wonderful days of a great camp I worked at and a great church I served at, and to kind of be tempted to think that that's where real ministry, that's where it was really happening, everything worked. But God, it only works because you were there, and it only works now because you're here. Don't let any of us make that mistake and say, man, I wish for that because if I was there, it'd all be fixed. No. It only happens. It only gets meaningful when we're walking with you and living out the calling you've placed on our lives as your people. Someone's here this morning, Jesus, that has never met you, has not yielded to you, is still stuck in the things that keep a relationship from happening with you. You call it sin. Thank you that you don't run from sinners. You say, come to me and I'll fix that. I'll forgive that. I'll let you begin a relationship with me that will truly deliver what you're looking for. Purpose, meaning, fulfillment, because it's my calling on your life. Thank you for these two that will be baptized now. Thank you for the way that your calling has changed their lives. Speak to us through that message too. In the name of Jesus, I pray.